Thank you very much for downloading the podcast. It was a busy week this week. I was joined by Meera Sayal, Carl Jenkins and Ian McKellen. Air Espanol by Pablo de Sarasate. Tianhua Yang was the violinist with the Orquesta Sinfónica de Navarra, conducted by Ernest Martinez Izquierdo. And Pablo de Sarasate has a link with Arthur Conan Doyle in that he appears in The Red-Headed League. Holmes and Watson attend a concert of his, so I'm afraid this is sounding really convoluted. I'm sorry, Ian, but it brings me quite neatly to my guest, Ian McKellen.
Hello.
Who is appearing as Sherlock Holmes in the film, Mr. Holmes, which is out on Friday.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Culture Club, Ian.
And
it's really good to see you. I love the film. I thought it was very poignant and engaging.
Yes.
And the way that it deals with age and unreliable memory. And yes. I just wondered what it was about the screenplay that attracted you to the role.
Well, it was a bit of cheekiness to think, oh, Robert Downey Jr. and Benedict Cumberbatch, Ian McKellen as Mr. Holmes. Well, why not? There were hundreds of actors before us trampling over Conan Doyle. But this is a different version. It's a different take. The idea that Sherlock is losing it, losing his mind a little bit, losing his memory, certainly, but discovering his humanity, I think that's why in the end the film's a success, is that it's quite a hopeful story, and he's a better man at the end of it, once he's investigated his last case that he didn't think was really properly reported by Dr. Watson 30 years before he went into retirement.
You are utterly believable as a 93-year-old. Your physical movements and that stiffness, and particularly the way when you sit in a chair, this is what old people do, they fall back because they can't control that movement.
It's not that clever. It's all too easy.
I wondered whether that was obviously also acute observation.
It is observation, but it's observation of your own body to begin with rather
yes.
than anybody else's. And anyone who's had an ache, whatever age they are, if they've got an actor's imagination, can remember what that ache was like and send it through their body so that the whole structure of the skeleton is just a bit, little bit creaky, and then you find yourself... So you're not giving yourself notes, you're giving yourself feelings, and it's the feeling that's represented in the way that the body collapses or creaks or fails to open up or whatever it does.
And there's great poignancy because, obviously, Holmes has had this brilliant mind and now his mental powers are waning. Mm. And there are moments when you write the name of the little boy.
Roger.
You write Roger on your cuff.
Yes.
And also, I thought particularly movingly, your doctor tells you to make marks in a diary when you forget names and places. And often there's a point in the film where you look through it and there are lots of these little marks.
Yeah.
Some obviously made with great sort of ferocity and frustration.
Yes, it's the doctor played wonderfully by my own mate Roger Allen. Last time we were together, he was Abenaza at the Old Vic, and I was Widow Twankey.
Oh,
we shared a dressing room and have been good friends ever since. So he came along to join in the fun, and yes, he gives me this book. Every time you forget something, make a mark, and some of the marks, yes, are clearly heartfelt. I wouldn't like to have to keep a book myself because I suspect there would be quite a lot of little marks in it. Of course, one becomes adept in covering up the fact that the memory
That's true.
Lets you down. And you say, oh, well, everybody forgets a name. Yeah, but not every day.
And we should actually pay tribute to the makeup artist because,
wonderful,
absolutely fantastic, utterly credible that you are 93 years old.
Dave Elsie has got this very simple method of aging the skin by painting a thin layer of rubber over it and just pulling your skin taut. And as the rubber dries, it pulls your skin into those wonderful actual wrinkles. There are actual wrinkles. And he does that very, very quickly. In 40 minutes, I can be transformed, and it takes almost as long to get off. And I'm afraid that you're left with a few wrinkles that you didn't have before. I think that's the only disadvantage of it.
Well, let's hear some music now, Ian,
yes.
from another of your big famous screen roles as Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings. And this is Breaking of the Fellowship on Classic FM. Breaking of the Fellowship from Lord of the Rings by Howard Shore, taken from the film Fellowship of the Ring. The Royal Philharmonic Orchestra was conducted by David Arnold. Well, this is Charlotte Green's Culture Club on Classic FM, and I'm delighted to have as my guest this afternoon the distinguished actor Ian McKellen. Ian, who were your acting heroes when you were growing up?
Well, people you've never heard of, like Geoffrey Banks, he actually taught me French at school, but in his spare time, he was a professional actor. He used to rush at the end of school from Bolton to Manchester and do a little broadcast for the old Children's Hour, and I thought that was the most romantic thing, that his voice was going out across the world, and yet he was just our French teacher. And the other amateur actors I worked with, because I never had ambitions to become a professional. I didn't think I was good enough. So people like Olivia and Peggy Ashcroft and Sam Wanamaker and others I saw at Stratford in Shakespeare were way beyond my league. So they didn't really become, they weren't even heroes. They were just too far distant. So it would be the local actors and the local actors who were in the repertory company that I used to go to in Bolton. John Sims, Arthur Leslie, who ended up behind the bar in Coronation Street in his retirement. He became one of the most famous actors in the country. But when I saw him, he was running the company in Wigan, the Frank Fortescue Players. So it's those sort of people who made the impact.
Yeah. Well, if we could now go back to your role as Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I mean, you've done some memorable work in the theatre, and I've been really lucky to see you as Richard III, King Lear, Iago in Othello. Oh, really, really lucky. Yeah. But you've now got a completely new fan base through the Lord of the Rings trilogy and The Hobbit. Yeah. What is it like suddenly having a global appeal?
Well, as someone who's rather shy and doesn't put himself into situations like a party full of strangers that would make me more shy and put me at a disadvantage, I now find that most places in the world there'll be somebody in the room or on the subway or in the street who recognises me as the actor who pretends to be Gandalf or Magneto, actually. And that's very nice for me because it's a friendly face and something in common, and I don't feel... I feel less shy. So it's been a real boost to my confidence and... I know what pleasure it gives because, you know, in the past when I've met an actor that I've admired, it's just to say thank you and just engage in a moment of looking into each other's eyes. Though, of course, these days that isn't always the case because they want to take a photograph of you.
They always want to take a photograph.
And they look into your eyes when you've long gone. That's a bit odd.
Do you change your technique when you're performing in front of a camera as opposed to being on a stage and projecting out to the far reaches, as it were?
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, in front of the camera, there shouldn't be any technique. There shouldn't be any projection. There should be just being the character, existing, and the camera will pick up every detail because it's so close. That doesn't apply when you're in a theatre and the audience can't quite see your face. Then your body will come into play and there will be all sorts of communication that wouldn't be appropriate for the camera. When you've done as much theatre as I have, it took me quite a long time to get the measure of what the camera requires. But it is always acting. It is always using your imagination. It is always, you know, make-believe, let's pretend, all that childish, childlike thinking that I'm not where I am, I could be somewhere else. Oh, it feels as if I am, and that's the moment you want the camera to turn.
Yes. Well, let's enjoy some more music now on Classic FM. I think this is a favourite of yours, the Etude in C-sharp minor by Chopin.
My father used to play it, not very well, on the upright piano just beneath my bedroom, so many a time I've tried to get to sleep with that in the background and happily failed because it's wonderful.
The Etude in C-sharp minor by Frédéric Chopin, and the pianist was Sviatoslav Richter. I'm Charlotte Green, and I'm joined in the Culture Club on Classic FM by Ian McKellen. Ian, how do you prepare before going on stage? I don't know whether you get pre-performance nerves, you may not, but I just wondered if you had a kind of set routine to centre yourself and focus.
I don't have to banish the demons that some actors have to do, and I always look forward to being in the presence of an audience. I mean, that is why we act. If there's no audience, there's no plays. There will be a film if there's no audience. That's the ironic thing. The film will just play through whether anyone's watching it or not, but a play, no. So, if anything, it's tempering my excitement rather than stealing myself for the difficulties. But there is rarely a day when I'm acting in a play when I don't think of it the minute I wake up. Oh, there's something going to happen today. What is it? Oh, of course, I'm going to do the play. By lunchtime, I will have to have stopped any other activities and really be preparing. Probably involve going to bed, actually, and just trying to empty the mind and getting into the theatre quite early on, maybe an hour before the performance, and just trying to let the day and its worries fall away so that you can concentrate. I think that's my approach.
Do you have any superstitions or not?
No, I'm one of the few actors who happily says Macbeth in the dressing room because it was a very lucky play for me. Yes. I got to play it with Judi Dench and it doesn't get better than that. You have to be careful of superstition because some people, like Patrick Stewart, when we shared a dressing room, if I said Macbeth in his company, I had to go out of the room and turn round and come back in again, and whatever the routine is. No, I don't think I do have any superstitions now.
Now, I saw you fairly recently at the Royal Festival Hall at the Daniel Barenboim concert, the Elgar and the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. So I'm guessing that music does play quite an important part in your life.
I can't believe the luck of living in the city where Daniel Barenboim regularly comes to play. And since that concert that you mentioned, I heard him play a couple of Schubert's
Sonatas, yes.
At the Royal Festival Hall.
Magnificent.
Yes, absolutely. Well, music hath charms, doesn't it? And I like nothing better. I'm hesitating, but I think it's true. When it comes to performance, than to see some musicians playing live. It doesn't have to be classical. I saw Sting and Paul Simon recently in concert, and that was overwhelming. I saw Alfie Beau singing away to his fans. I love that too. And yet music in the house, I very rarely have. I've never got into that habit of having music on in the background, and music for me is for listening to. And
I'm concentrating on fully.
Yes. And the trouble is, if I hear classic FM, I have to stop everything whilst I listen to the music. I can't have it on while I'm cooking or, writing a letter or something. It just wouldn't work for me. My father used to play the piano, my sister played the piano, I learned to play the piano, but eventually persuaded my parents that I could stop playing the piano. Should never have done that, but everything was set up for me to have a really lively, a passionate concern for music, and it's never really come about, except that I loved the excitement of a live performance, and when you get a total master who rehearses 8 hours a day for our benefit, you know, so that the music can just flow out, that's so overwhelming and beyond any endeavour that I've ever put into my work.
It was very, very special, wasn't it? You felt privileged to have been there.
Yes.
But as I have felt watching you in the theatre, so I think you do yourself down. But
thank you.
Ian, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for joining me. And I should say that Mr. Holmes is out in cinemas this Friday.
It is.
And we're now going to play some Vivaldi. This is the first movement of Winter from his Four Seasons.
Charlotte Green's Culture Club on Classic FM.
Well, I'm Charlotte Green and I'm very happy to welcome Meera Sial to Classic FM and the Culture Club. Thank you very much for coming in, Meera.
Thank you.
Now, you've got a new book out, which I think is your third, The House of Hidden Mothers. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to know, how do ideas come to you? I mean, this is about surrogacy, isn't it? There are two very strong central female characters, Sharma and Mala. And it's about the Indian surrogacy industry, which I hadn't realised was such big business.
Yes.
I mean, really, really flourishing.
Biggest in the world, in fact.
Which is, I found quite astonishing. How does that idea come to you? Does it spring fully formed into your head, or do you mull it over for a while?
Well, I'd been sort of searching for something to write about for my third book because I hadn't had the idea that really made me go, that's it,
yes.
That sort of tingly feeling at the back of the neck. And I was channel flicking and I happened to chance upon this documentary, and the initial image was a row of heavily pregnant Indian women, obviously quite poor women, sitting on dormitory beds, looking a bit like brood hens. I'm thinking, what on earth is this? And actually watching this documentary and finding out that the surrogacy industry in India is the biggest in the world, $4.5 billion a year, and because it's the cheapest. And so what would cost you $100,000 maybe in America will cost you barely 20 in India. And it's also deregulated. And I just thought, this is really interesting. This says all kinds of things about the politics of fertility. It's a great metaphor between the West and the East and what we're outsourcing. It's my home country. It also says a lot about the relationship between India and England. And at the heart of it, I immediately thought, what is that relationship between a woman who's desperate for a child and this woman 5,000 miles away, who's the answer to her dream? So both of them need each other very much, but it's a forced, strange relationship. Is it exploitation or is it the answer to somebody's dreams?
They're strong characters. They're really well written. And what I found fascinating was that power struggle between them.
Yes.
Which is absolutely intriguing. And at one moment, one is up and then the other. And I found myself supporting Sharma at one stage and then Mala at another stage. So there's that very interesting counterpoint, isn't there?
Yes, I'm really glad you said that, because that's exactly how I wanted the reader to feel, that in a way your loyalty and your perspective keep shifting according to which woman's eyes you're seeing it through. You absolutely understand why Sharma has this desperate need for a child and her economic reasons for doing it. You absolutely understand why Mala's doing it. What is interesting, is, as you say, is when the power balance shifts because of unexpected circumstances. And then I think the really big questions come up about whose womb is it?
Yes.
Whose baby is this, really? Who has the right to bear this child or keep this child or even indeed decide, should one be able to go through this process?
Are there elements of you in both characters, or is this genuinely something that has just sprung from your imagination?
Well, I have a blended family too. I have 13 years between my children, so I was a late mother with the second one. And if I hadn't been lucky enough to have the second one, I'm sure I would have looked at other options. And I deliberately made Sharma 48 because I wanted to make her the age where most people, including her very annoyed daughter, would be going...
I was going to say, she's appalled, isn't she?
You are 2 years off 50. Why the hell are you doing this? But that also begs the question of who is it to say when you stop? Because science makes anything possible.
Well, let's have some music now. This is a real favourite on Classic FM. It's by Mozart, the second movement of his clarinet quintet. That was the second movement of the clarinet quintet by Mozart. The soloist was Andrew Mariner with the Academy of St Martin in the Fields Chamber Ensemble. This is the Culture Club on Classic FM. I'm Charlotte Green and I'm delighted to have Meera Sayal as my guest. Meera, writing is a very solitary process, isn't it? Whereas when you do theatre and television work, that's much more collaborative. I wonder which process is more satisfying for you.
Oh, well, actually the variety between the two is wonderful, because I don't think I could just be a writer. It is solitary. Mm. It is quite lonely. You have the terror of the blank page. And after a while, I am the shuffling person in the pyjamas who hasn't talked to anybody human for days and his stuff in my head. And I think I really should get out. And then you have the wonderful communality of...
Yes.
I've just finished a play at the National for 9 months, being part of just an amazing cast. And then that's so busy. There's almost the balm of being able to withdraw from that, and then
so you can get the best of both worlds, really.
Yes, in a way, yes, you can. And also, I think one discipline feeds the other. I think being an actor has, I hope, made me a better writer and vice versa.
Because that's interesting.
You read a lot of scripts. You tend to know what good dialogue sounds like. You understand more about structure. Psychology of character is what you're all about as an actor, and that's yes. very useful when you're creating characters in fiction. So they are complementary, I think.
Now, you just mentioned you finished a 9-month run at the National Theatre in David Hare's Behind the Beautiful Forevers. How do you keep a performance fresh when you have a really long run like that and you're performing virtually every night?
Mm. Well, the National has a slight advantage in that you don't do the 8 shows a week every week grind that you have in the West End. Actually, we have built-in breaks because it's a rep system. So that has a lot to do with it. You genuinely come back not only refreshed, but a tiny bit frightened that you're not going to remember your lines when you haven't been doing it for a week. But I think with the great plays, and I think David Hare is a great writer, and this was a great play, it's amazing. There are so many layers in great writing. And I can genuinely say up until the very last week, we were coming off stage after scenes and going, I've never done that before. That was amazing. That little thing, that little look you did, and I didn't know you could play that line that way. And
that's
so
wonderful.
We were still, it was brilliant.
One final question. This is Classic FM, so obviously we like to ask about music. Does music play an integral part in your life and classical music, perhaps?
I'm surrounded by music, actually. My daughter is a very good piano player, but she actually switched from classical to jazz. So she plays a lot of jazz around the house. My son loves singing.
Because you're a bit of a singer yourself, aren't you?
Well, I'm a warbler. I think
you're doing yourself down saying that.
I used to sing in a jazz quintet, actually. But, you know, tunes for people to eat dinner to. I'm used to, if I don't hear the clinking of cutlery, I don't feel I'm singing, really. But classical music, well, you know, because I guess we're from a different culture.
Yes,
Western classical music, I really had not heard of until I heard it on adverts. But, you know, a good tune is a good tune. So I was the person who went into the tiny little record shop in Walsall and said, have you got the British Airways advert music? And then had to go, la, 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 la.
And sing it.
But, you know, that doesn't...
But that's the way in, isn't it? I mean, how you begin to learn.
It absolutely is. Because, you know, a beautiful tune is a beautiful tune, and it's beyond language and it's beyond culture. So I've discovered tunes since then. And I think you just have to not be embarrassed about going, I wasn't brought up with this and I don't know anything about the history of classical music, but I heard this tune and it doesn't matter where I heard it, but it moved me. And can you tell me what it is?
Well, that's a really good note to end on. This has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much, Meera. And I should say that your book, The House of Hidden Mothers, is out now. And on the basis of having read that, I do hope you're going to be writing a fourth before very long.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was The Benedictus from The Armed Man by Carl Jenkins. Guy Johnston was the cellist. The London Philharmonic Orchestra and the National Youth Choir of Great Britain was conducted by Carl, who's in the studio with me now. Welcome, Carl. This is your second visit to the Culture Club. Now, we've brought you in today because there's a great reason for celebrations. You have just received a knighthood yesterday in the Queen's Birthday Honours, so many congratulations.
Thank you.
You're now Sir Carl Jenkins. I know this is an absolute cliche of a question, but you must be absolutely delighted.
I am. The reaction was thrilled, bemused, slightly embarrassed, excited and delighted. So I've never been a favourite with the establishment. So in many ways, it's very unexpected.
And how did you learn about it?
I had a letter from the Cabinet Office inviting me to accept.
So there is the
about a month ago. Yeah,
there is
a form. Yes, indeed. One fills out a form.
Yes.
With some questions, like a questionnaire.
And you don't yet know when you're going to Buckingham Palace?
No, not at all.
Well, many congratulations. It's tremendous news.
Many thanks.
I'm really delighted for you. Now, this really is a year of big highlights because you're going to publish an autobiography in September.
Indeed, yes.
What's the title?
It's called Still With The Music. The title came from, I was in Swansea Market about 20, 30 years ago, a long time. And one of the local cockle vendors there, a lady I knew actually, but I hadn't noticed her at this particular time. She shouted out across the market stalls. It was quite elongated, the Carl. She said, "Carl, still with the music?" So that's where it came from, you know. Yes. So yeah, I was still with the music, and I still am.
Still
with the
title.
Music.
What about the process and the preparation and all those memories, of course, looking back from childhood onwards? Did you keep a diary? Do you keep a diary now?
No, I don't. The early part up to university and my coming to the Royal Academy in London were fairly vivid and clear. Well, all my life is, really. But once I started recording and doing concerts in various genres, from jazz to whatever, it got a bit confused. But nowadays, with the wonders of the internet, I can find out about myself and where I was when, where I was when, and in what year. You know,
so that
it did help actually with cataloguing album releases and various things. You know, and of course, my published music with Boozy and Hawkes, that's catalogued, so a sequence of works is there for me to ask. You know, so in the end, it was quite relatively easy to source what I wanted to say. You know, from the past.
Well, I actually wrote an autobiography last year, and one of the great pleasures for me was looking at old family photographs and deciding what photographs were going to go in the book, because those triggered so many memories of childhood, and I wondered if you...
Yes, absolutely. No, I've done that. I've kind of trawled through some family albums and photographs, some of which are quite interesting, because I had a Swedish side as well as the Welsh side.
Yes.
My grandfather was Swedish. My great-great-great-great-grandfather was head gardener to the King of Sweden, would you believe?
Fascinating job.
So there was that side. So I have many photos from there. I lived there for a while when I was very young, when my mother was ill.
Yes.
She died before I was five, essentially. So, yeah, that is fascinating, and the Welsh side as well.
And there a lot of music in your family? I think your father was...
Yeah, my father was a musician.
Organist.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
Yes.
There's lots of singing in the family, but he would be the only kind of... fluent or trained, although trained in an amateur way, kind of musician.
Yeah.
And of course, now I have grandchildren, so it's the photos of them as well have to be included. Not have to be, I want them to be, you
yes,
know. But
of course. We're going to play some more of your music, Carl. This is the Laudamus Te from Gloria, and it's played by the London Philharmonic Orchestra and the National Youth Choir of Great Britain. That was the Laudamus Te from the Gloria by Carl Jenkins, played by the London Philharmonic Orchestra and sung by the National Youth Choir of Great Britain. The conductor was Carl Jenkins himself. Carl, have you always composed music? I just wondered at what stage you realised that you could make a career out of being a musician.
Well, I never did. I'm still thinking about it, actually. No, I had this kind of... In my teenage years, I kind of fell in love with jazz music. Mm. And classical music at that time had to be, I say had to be, the norm was to write in a very difficult atonal style, which didn't appeal to me. So I'm fascinated by jazz. So I became a jazz composer, along became whatever else I've become. And I've been a musical tourist, being a jazz musician, a progressive rock musician, writing for advertisements. And then this latter part of my career, which is why I'm here. But I learned a lot in advertising about techniques of various... ethnic music that has stood me in great stead, really. So it's been an educational process the whole way. And it's purely by accident I am where I am. I'd never have believed when I was 20, whatever, when I left the Royal Academy that I'd be doing this now. It's been quite remarkable, really, in having four careers.
Yes, that is quite extraordinary,
in a way.
Now, you talk about advertising and writing music for advertising. That's very interesting because another guest on this show, I've just been talking to the actress Meera Sayal, and she wasn't really brought up with classical music but came to it through, and she mentioned specifically the British Airways advert. And she'd go into a record shop and ask, have you got the music to the British Airways advert?
Yes.
And she made a very valid point that a good tune is a good tune, and I'm sure you'd agree
with
that.
Well, that's my philosophy as well. I mean, that's what I kind of adhere to, really. It's, all right, accessible, tuneful music. So some people found Addie Amos through the commercial that was used. Again, and another piece of mine I found out, quite a staggering statistic the other day, actually, that the Dies Irae from the Requiem, which was used on a Lynx commercial, the ad has had 57 million hits on YouTube.
Well, that's astounding.
Which is kind of unbelievable.
57 million?
Yes, apparently.
That's absolutely,
and I should add, I don't get a cent from that, so...
What a shame.
Indeed.
War's the pity.
Yes.
Now, I was looking very briefly at some of the extracts from your autobiography, and I noticed that you're not a great fan of critics, are you? You have some quite trenchant things to say about critics.
Yes, I do. Well, I don't think they fit for purpose, really, and I've never understood this, even when I was a jazz musician, how and why people give any kind of credence to what they say, because they have no talent or ability themselves, so... quite a simplistic view, really, but I think it's quite true, really. But I rejoice in the fact that I've been honoured, and without... I'm 100% critic-proof, and whatever they say or do, they can't affect my career, and have not affected my career. So the music speaks for itself, and people respond to it. And I don't make great claims to be the next Mozart or whatever, and I'm not trying to be. So I'm true to myself... write in a kind of intuitive way, to an extent, but in an intuition based on a lot of classical training.
Yes.
So it's well-crafted, and I appeal to people, and I'm quite happy
you
with
certainly
my,
do
with
appeal
my niche,
to people.
Actually.
And it's very true. I thought it was lovely what you said, that you're true to yourself, and I think that's incredibly important.
Well, it is, because I don't think one can ever second-guess what people want, because it's, you know, kiss of death commercially.
Yes.
If one's thinking about being commercial, I write what I want to write. Happily, people... like it. Some critic once wrote to me what was meant to be a kind of derogatory remark was that I was emotionally manipulative. Well, I think that's an amazing compliment to pay someone. You can move people, you know, make them laugh or cry or whatever.
I would have thought that was high praise.
Yes, indeed.
Carl, thank you very much indeed for coming in, and congratulations once again.
My pleasure, Charlotte.
You're now Sir Carl Jenkins.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, I do hope you'll join me in the Culture Club next Sunday, when my guests will include the author Bernard Cornwell, who'll be talking about the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo.